studying non-elite women is important. It shows not just that there is change from the bottom up, but that bottom-up change can be sustainable because it changes the incentives of the whole system.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The standard measure of the influence of women in politics is the number of seats they hold in Parliament. It's easy enough to count and it's internationally comparable. But what does it tell us about the power of women who engage in politics through voting, attending public meetings, protesting, or are just simply trying to get someone to fix the water supply? Soleil Prelerman of Stanford University is one of the authors of a new review of the research into the role of non-elite women in politics. She joins me now. Soleil, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks so much. Thrilled to be here.
Soleil, I listed some of the ways in which non-elite women might participate in politics. Let's do our definitions first. How do we define who is elite and who is non-elite?
It's funny, you would think this should be pretty obvious, but I remember my very first week of grad school sitting in a class, hearing the word elite used over and over and over again, and feeling like I just didn't speak the language. And what did that mean about my place? And in reality, I've come to realize now that there isn't actually a consensus in the academic literature on what counts as elite, even though it's a term we use a lot. Mm-hmm. And so in some domains, elite is used to distinguish people in leadership roles, parliamentarians, from everyday citizens who you would think of as non-elites. In other domains, eliteness is used to refer to people with socioeconomic privilege, those who have high levels of education, who are business elites, who come from high status professions, academics. And so non-elites would be people who lack these indicators. And so this is the challenge that we encountered, was how do we unite these definitions to come up with a coherent understanding of eliteness and therefore non-eliteness? The definition we ended up using to define eliteness was basing it on access to power. We saw that as what unifies these different approaches. And so political elites are those with access to political power. Though access to power does not mean actually holding power. Mm-hmm. And that means that it would include people who actually hold power, who are in positions of political authority, like those who are elected representatives. So thinking back to where you started us. But it would also include academics, business executives, those whose socioeconomic characteristics mean that they have more access to power. And non-elites are those who lack access to power. And so the struggles to gain access to politics are quite different when we think about what it means to not have power, try to access both power and institutions at the same time.
Why is it instructive? Why is it important to make this distinction between elite and non-elite?
I think there are lots of reasons that this is important generally, but I'm going to talk a little bit in the context of this paper where we're thinking about gender equality in politics. And so why this might matter for how we think about gender equality. It affects what we see as the starting point for how we get towards equality and the starting point for policymaking. You started us off by talking about when we say reducing gender gaps in political participation, really what people mean is getting women elected into office. Yeah. And so that's concentrating our focus on elite women. And as a result, the orientation around policymaking through quotas and through other institutions that are designed to get women into elite positions. That is important, but it changes what we're trying to accomplish, and it has a set of assumptions underlying it that if you can expand the set of women who are elite, who are in the pool of political power holders, that will have cascading consequences for women who are not elite, and that will reduce gender inequalities more generally. The evidence there is pretty mixed. It's really important to think about what the different challenges may be, what the roots of inequalities may be for these different groups, how they differ, and how that intersects with policymaking. The second reason that this matters is when it comes to what we imagine as the consequences of equality. So if we actually achieved greater representation of women in politics, either in elite spaces or as non-elite in everyday spaces of political participation, what would happen? What would be the consequence for governance, for policymaking more generally? And this is a term that we call substantive representation, the representation of women's interests in politics. We would only expect a focus on elites to truly reflect what non-elites care about if we imagine they have the same preferences. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that they don't, that non-elite women, everyday women, women who don't have access to power have different preferences from women who have more power. And as a result, empowering these groups, giving them more access to political institution is likely to have different consequences, cascading consequences for governance more generally.
You did mention the evidence that non-elite women might have different preferences. This is a review of the existing literature. How well is it done at separating the outcomes and the preferences of elite and non-elite women?
I think there's a lot of things that one could say about measurement challenges, estimation challenges, even just the challenges of what questions we ask and where we ask them. And so a few things I would highlight here. One is that we almost never evaluate or measure and compare the preferences of elites from non-elites. There's a presumption in much of the literature that those two preferences are the same. As a result, differences in policymaking reflect the elite women representing their interests. And so any evidence that we have right now about the differences between these preferences really comes from looking at policymaking and when it is that elite women don't reflect non-elite women's preferences. But the question is, does that mean that they hold different preferences? That elite women, for example, because of their position in the social hierarchy, actually have many of the same preferences as elite or more powerful men? Or is it that they have the same preferences, but institutions constrain their behavior? The first thing that we really struggle with is measuring preferences more generally and thinking about how they relate. It's easy to see and count how many women are in seats in national parliaments. Mm-hmm. And these data are used to motivate gender progress. It's much harder to measure the outcomes and behaviors of non-elite women. I think that that's part of what has led to a conflation at times, and more generally, just a separation of the study of these two domains. That when we think about non-elite women, the number one thing we think about is whether or not they vote. And voting is an articulation of their preferences. But what we see is that the largest gender gaps in non-elite women's political participation come from non-electoral politics, come from the ways that they engage with the state on all the days in between elections. And those larger gender gaps hold across regions of the world in different domains. There's more and more research from everywhere, from South Asia to Sweden to the US, that's showing that many women don't vote in line with their true preferences, that they vote in accordance with male elites or men who hold power over their lives. And so in the study of women's political participation generally, I think we face some big measurement challenges, or at least a dearth of data at the moment on widespread ways of capturing preferences, interests, and various levels and forms of participation. And alongside that, we often have silos between people who think about elites and people who think about non-elites. And rarely do we have a conversation between those two domains, both in terms of what preferences look like and what is the process of filtering those preferences into different outcomes.
So, Soleil, given your definition of what is elite and non-elite, my first guess about the constraint that non-elite women would face when they want to participate in politics is access to material resources. So I'm talking about things like access to transport or maybe to childcare if they wanted to take part in a political process. Does the evidence show that that's the case?
Yeah, I think your intuition is the intuition of so many, that these are exactly the constraints that matter. And In fact, the dominant theory in the literature is that these kinds of resources are what underlie political gender gaps. And this is what we think about at the micro level day to day. I'm responsible for childcare. That makes it harder to participate in politics. But also at the macro level, that levels of development, levels of access to economic institutions, labor market participation, that is what is going to drive gender equality. That if we get development, we get gender equality. The evidence is actually more mixed than what we would typically expect to see. In general, we see that at a person level, income is generally uncorrelated with turnout and political participation.
That's a big surprise, isn't it? Well, it is a big surprise to me.
Yeah. Even at a macro level, the level of a country's income, the level of GDP, only in some places is that correlated with non-elite women's political participation. But we see similarly that in many places, it isn't. And so money isn't what is buying women access to politics. The idea that you could fill their coffers with higher income and that would change things doesn't seem to bear out. Why that is, I don't know that we know yet. In line with income, you would then expect, what does that mean about labor force participation? And what we see when we look at that at a micro level is that women who participate in the labor market are much more likely to participate in politics, but it's not because of income. So it really reinforces that statement about income. And it seems that as more and more research is being done, that it's about networks and information and the other things that happen when you show up at work, at not raising your income and therefore taking that income home and having more bargaining power, using that income to buy you access to transportation or childcare. But it's about the social connections that you make, the access to information you have that comes as a result of being in the labor market that matters.
How does that work then? How do social connections matter?
So social connections are how you access information. In other research that I've done, we've asked men and women who they discuss politics with. It's really striking the differences that you see. Men say that they discuss politics with men outside of their household. Mm-hmm. This is in rural India, I should caveat. 99% of the people they discuss politics with are men outside of their homes. Women say that about half of the people they discuss politics with are those inside their homes. I think that highlights a really important way that networks matter. So if the information that women are getting is coming to them through the men in their homes, that is shaping how they might even imagine their political participation space, and it's shrinking the set of information that they could have access to. I think it's also quite telling that the people we interviewed are from the same households. And so women think they're talking to men about politics, and men don't think they're talking to the women in their home about politics. So it really already starts to tell you something about how information actually translates into a form of power and therefore political access. So we really see huge gender gaps across the world in who and how much people discuss politics. Networks serve another purpose, though, which is they can apply social pressure either to participate or not to participate. You know, we can think about, I actually don't know if this happens in the UK, but in the US, when we vote, we get stickers that we put on our shirts to tell everyone else that we voted and subtly tell you.
We don't get that.
Don't do this. You don't pressure each other to vote through social sanctions. But networks can encourage or discourage your participation. And I think this is a particularly important thing in the context of women's participation, because if your network is concentrated only amongst men and particularly amongst men in your household, there's a lot of evidence that shows that that suppresses your participation. But alternatively, there's a pretty big body of research that says that when women have networks outside of their homes, whether that's through women's groups, microcredit groups, churches, labor unions, friendship groups more generally, that encourages their participation and encourages their participation both by expanding their information set, but also by providing them with a support structure to show up, gain access to places they haven't gained access to. When women's participation challenges things, it provides women with safety to protect them from any backlash they may get. We know that women face a lot more violence in politics than men. And so networks fill a lot of gender gaps that we see between men and women.
All around the world, policy has tried to increase the power and the representation of women in political decision-making by creating new institutions. You mentioned one already, quotas or types of proportional representation. Is there evidence that this helps non-elite women?
Quotas are the most prolific women's empowerment program policy across the world. More than 100 countries have adopted a form of electoral quota for women. And so we've really seen an organization, a coalescence around quotas as one of the key drivers of increasing women's representation. The initial theory was that if you put women into positions of eliteness through representation, that will both cascade into more representation, more participation, and cascade into different policymaking that supports women's interests. The evidence around this is unfortunately quite mixed. We do see that these institutions matter and they have some impact on women's representation. They do increase some women's participation in some domains to some levels, but they have not closed the gender gap in political participation. And in many countries, we observe either no effect on political participation of non-elites, or even in some contexts, a negative, depressing effect on women's participation. And that, of course, then has consequences for what policies are made. We see similar controversial and conflicting evidence around the representation of women's interests in response to these institutions.
Now, you also focus in this paper on the impact of patriarchal norms. If, for example, in South Asia, a husband is controlling whether and how his wife votes, or if in the United States, women just don't see politics as their place, is this the same set of norms at play?
A yes and a no. Both of what you describe and articulate stem from patriarchal norms, but the nature of norms varies across contexts. Often, we like to categorize the world based on how patriarchal it is.
Yes.
What are the constraints in patriarchal societies? And what is not happening in non-patriarchal societies? But all societies are patriarchal. The nature of patriarchy and the way that it constrains women looks different across different contexts. In places like South Asia, we have what you see, more explicit control of women's behavior. That explicit control is socially acceptable. It's fine for women to need permission to travel anywhere. And therefore, for men to say, politics is my domain, you stay home. And we have lots of evidence that show that that gatekeeping exists. But equally, we have a lot of evidence that in the US, socialization that happens early on into what is and isn't acceptable, into how you imagine yourself in navigating the political world. And a refrain that I heard throughout a lot of my life is, you know, well, politics just isn't my space. You know, I'm not that interested in politics. But you hear that far more often among women than you do among men. And that bears out in the research too. We see large gender gaps in political interest in the global north, and particularly in the US and Europe. And those gender gaps in political interest correlate with gender gaps in political participation. We want to push back on the idea that patriarchy in terms of levels is what might drive differences in political participation. There might be varieties of patriarchy, and the nature of how patriarchy operates in a particular context, whether it's explicit control versus internalized imaginations, will shape what kinds of outcomes you see in terms of women's political participation.
Do you think that there is any type of patriarchal behavior that has a particular influence on what we're talking about today, the outcomes for non-elite women? Or, as you say, is it really very context dependent?
I think it's quite context dependent, but we can take some of the more extreme cases of explicit control and socially sanctioned control. A lot of the research on this emanates from South Asia. And those are also the contexts where we see the largest gender gaps in political participation. In those contexts, this explicit control can translate into a lack of agency in political decision making. And it's something I've spent a long time trying to figure out how we measure. When we think about where measurement needs to go, I think this is something we never measure and we should. Imagine a woman who's going to vote. You want to vote for party A, but the male gatekeeper in your life wants you to vote for party B. Would you go with what you want or would you go with what they want? In at least 50% of women, they say they would go with what the male gatekeeper wanted. Even when they're showing up to participate their vote choices are not independent. We know from really important work by Sarah Kahn that the women who lack agency are the ones whose preferences are most distinct from their male gatekeepers. And historically, there were institutions like coverture that said women didn't need the right to vote because their husbands would vote exactly the same as them. And so why duplicate the numbers? And that was part of the justification for not giving women the vote. What this research shows is that in many contexts, even though women have the right to vote and do show up to vote, they're still manifesting that same pattern, but not because they want to and not because their preferences look the same as their husbands, but because the way the strictness and the way that these patriarchal norms manifest really constrain their behavior and their choices. You asked a question about, is there a particular form of patriarchal norm that has important consequences? I highlight this one because it has consequences for behavior, but it also has consequences for whether that behavior itself is reflective of independent decision-making and agentic choice. And I think that's really, really important to get to the bottom of.
Tell me a little bit about what policy might work, what policy is working. We spoke about the efforts that are made to get elite women representation, as you say, more than 100 countries. If we do elect more women, what is the likelihood that it will lead to better outcomes for non-elite women?
Gender equality does not have a silver bullet solution. And attempting to find a single policy that solves these very deeply entrenched gender gaps is what will lead us to playing a game of whack-a-mole, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that a little with quotas. So I'm going to start with a little pessimism, but then I promise we'll get to some optimism. When we think about a lot of quota institutions, there's a huge body of research across the world that shows that these institutions can work, but they also can be co-opted. We see parties fielding women in seats where they're going to lose. In the context of India, my work and others at the moment is showing that if you look at many campaign ads in India for quota seats, what you see is the woman's name in the man's photo, because you know who you're actually electing when you choose the woman. We see lots of iterations of these institutions just not working as they're supposed to. But that doesn't mean that representation itself can't work. How can we fortify existing policies and institutions to actually do what they're supposed to ensure that women don't just have seats at the table, but they have authority in those seats. They have the ability to raise different demands. They have power within parliaments. They don't just sit on the lowest committees, but they're represented across all committees. In local quotas, how do we ensure that these women have access to support structures so that they can execute their agendas and policymaking? One component of this is figuring out how ensuring women's seat at the table ensures their voice at the table. And I think the other component is ensuring that women's seat at the table through their electoral representation is matched to seeing women as a constituency, a voting constituency, a political constituency that all politicians need to be responsive to. I think that's when we're going to start to see sort of the real magic happening, is the link between elite and non-elite participation and seeing women as a coalition that you have to respond to, and therefore that cascades into greater participation.
If non-elite women want to take some agency and to change their situation themselves, if they did this within these very restrictive patriarchal norms, which are very hard to change, we all acknowledge that, how much can they achieve?
I really like this question because it speaks to the body of work that I've been working on for the last decade, separate from even this project. A lot of people would imagine there's not much you can do, that circumstance, mm-hmm. systems, and structures mean that you're stuck. And honestly, even when I started doing this research, I came in with a bit of that intuition that the system, the structure had to change before, and so it had to be top down. particularly in the global South right now, we're seeing women take change in their hands. To go back to our conversation earlier about networks, I think that's mm-hmm. how this is happening. I think collective action is the tool that women are using to gain access to politics. It's gaining access to politics that's allowing them to renegotiate norms. So instead of having norms change first, politics is the space in which they can navigate and create norm change, which then hopefully will have larger cascading effects on other domains of life. And all of this could become a self-enforcing equilibrium change. I've spent the last 15 years studying India and a context where we've seen some of the largest gender gaps in participation. Mm. And yet in the last national election, women voted at higher rates than men. This is in recent elections, we saw women turning out more than men and really challenging the system. And we're seeing parties respond by offering policies that represent women. And this all started from bottom-up mobilization. Women making demands, saying, you know, you have to take us seriously. And I think that's really why studying non-elite women is important. It shows not just that there is change from the bottom up, but that bottom-up change can be sustainable because it changes the incentives of the whole system.
You've dedicated a lot of time to researching this topic, studying it. How much do we still not know that it would be good to know if we are going to make better policy in this area?
So much. I think there's so much to study, and I think that's exciting. I think there's a lot of space to learn. And I think it also is frustrating in that it means that there's so much policymaking that is happening without a huge evidence base behind it. So we've built, and by we, I mean the scholars, my four figures in the field, have built an incredible body of knowledge about quotas. And I think we have a pretty good sense of how, when, why quotas work. But I think for non-elite women, there's a lot we don't know. For example, you mentioned earlier the importance of childcare. Mm-hmm. We don't have definitive evidence. We don't have much evidence at all as to the importance of childcare, having young children, on the impact of women's political behavior. And I think this is a function of the data constraints we've already talked about. I think it's a function of the challenges to really getting to true deep causal estimates around the impact of these various attributes. And I think it's about the complexity of the issue. Things work differently in different countries. Is that because of the context or is that because of the study itself? I don't think we have that answer yet. When do resources, when do norms, when do institutions end up mattering and why in certain places and not others?
But if I was one of those policymakers, as you are one of the experts in this field, what would you advise me either to do or to stop doing that would have a beneficial effect for non-elite women?
The first thing I would advise you to do is to collect some data on the context in which you're operating. Most NGOs and policymakers have done a version of that, but I would think about which domains of political participation are lacking. You know, it's a big difference if you're trying to get women to vote and or register to vote than if you're trying to get women to show up in public meetings versus if you're trying to increase women's access to campaign finance. Then I would think about what are the norms around political engagement in the context in which you're operating. Is it that women aren't allowed to participate or that they just internalize that it isn't their role? Gaining that understanding can help navigate the research that we have to know what are the policies likely to work. If the primary goal is to really increase women's voice, I would think about which voices, whether the demands that women want to make are things that benefit everyone, that don't threaten existing power structures. If that's the case, then part of the process is helping men see that women's participation is not just not threatening, but is mutually beneficial. When women's participation can be framed as collectively beneficial, it becomes much easier to navigate norms. But sometimes what women want does threaten the status quo, and I think that generates a different set of conclusions, in which case the policy that you make needs to be one that protects women from the fact that they're likely to experience backlash because they're threatening the existing power structure. depending on the nature of the problem that you as a policymaker want to solve, you may want to invest in coalition building between men and women and filling whatever the gap may be, whether it's information access or resource access or access to policymakers, or providing women with the safe spaces that allow them to make the demands and make the claims through investing in collective action networks, local communities, and helping women sort of make the demands they already want to make.
It's such an exciting area of research and such a challenging area for policy. Soleil, thank you very much for talking about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
If you want to read the paper, I'm sure you do. It is called Non-Elite Women's Participation in Politics. It was published in the Annual Review of Political Science in 2026. That's in volume 29. Authors, Peace Medier and Soledad Prileman. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, at voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you've just heard, tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.